Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Ashley Cowger, reading from her collection of stories, Peter Never Came, published by Autumn House Press. Ashley Cowger holds an MFA in creative writing from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Her short fiction has appeared in several literary journals and has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. She teaches at Zane State College and is the editor and co-founder of the online journal MFA-MFU. She lives in Southeast Ohio with her husband, cat, young daughter, and a collection of overweight stuffed animals. Welcome to Prosody, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
How about we start out tonight with you reading a little bit?
Okay. I'm going to read a really short story from my book, and this is just a flash fiction piece, and it's titled The Number One. On Friday, November 30th, 2007, at precisely 7:48 in the morning, Eastern Standard Time, Anna Kelsey McMillan became, for the duration of 5.3 minutes, the number one most beautiful woman in the world. 3 of those 5 minutes Anna spent in her car, alone, where nobody saw her in all of her splendor. But Anna spent 2 of those glorious minutes traversing the parking lot of the large business complex, where she was expected, at 8 o'clock, to commence her presentation on farmed salmon. 3 people were in the parking lot with Anna during those 2 minutes. The first, Charles B. Abrams, was on his cell phone and hardly even noticed Anna as she passed by. The second person, Clarice Mandel, who was, that morning, having a self-described bad hair day and believed herself to be the number one ugliest woman in the world, though she was actually number 1,346,412,912 at that exact moment, noticed Anna and responded with an instinctive twinge of jealous spite. Fortunately, the third person in the parking lot that morning, John Quinn, not only noticed Anna, but appreciated her dazzling beauty, her resplendent loveliness. John was on his way to a meeting, and his mind was bogged down with the endless streams of data he would soon be discussing with his co-workers. He had only just parked, just climbed out of his car, when he was blindsided by Anna's beauty. As Anna passed, John mentally acknowledged that she was the most beautiful woman that he had ever seen, not knowing that she was, at that moment, the most beautiful woman, period. Mesmerized, he dropped the briefcase he had been about to pull from his back seat and, instead, watched Anna strut away. No thought of his wife and how she might feel to know her husband was at that moment in a parking lot ogling another woman entered his mind. But his wife didn't know, and anyway, it wasn't as though there were anything sexual about it. No, John wasn't admiring Anna's plump frame, her soft brown curls, and her pale pink cheeks out of some animalistic response of arousal. She was simply beautiful. Surely his wife wouldn't mind another glance. John allowed himself to gaze for 4.6 seconds at the back of Anna's thick curls as she made her way towards the building before he climbed right back into his car and drove straight home to his own, he suddenly remembered, very attractive wife. When he would arrive home, 32.8 minutes later, he would take his wife in his arms and carry her to the bedroom, where they would have the 3,489,674,123rd most passionate sex of all time. Afterwards, he would call in sick to the meeting, but first things first. John's wife would never know that it had been Anna that reminded her husband how much he loved her, nor that 43.7 seconds after John turned away from Anna, a swift breeze blew a mocha-colored strand of hair into Anna's right eye, the same strand of hair which had, 5.3 minutes earlier, been wafted by her car's rogue air conditioner precariously close to her eye. Without missing a step, Anna puffed a blast of air from her lips upward, driving the hair out of her eye and making her the 500,250,009th most beautiful woman in the world. Still no small accomplishment. Anna didn't know that for 5 brief minutes she had been number one, and so she didn't miss it. Instead, she made her way towards the building, where she would demonstrate for her boss and a small committee of investors that she was the number 4,300,979th most knowledgeable person in the world on farmed salmon. Just that morning, she had been the 4,300,978th most knowledgeable. But as Anna was making her way to the parking lot, fiddling with her air conditioner and being beautiful, 15-year-old Susie Ann Canfield of Phoenix, Arizona, was looking up information on farmed salmon for a school report and had surpassed Anna in knowledge on that particular subject. Had Anna known that a teenager knew more about her field than she herself did, she may have lost the resolve to give her presentation to these investors, whose money Anna's company very badly needed. She may have just not shown up, because she wouldn't probably have also known that Susie would only remain ahead of her for 4 days. Once Susie handed in her report on Monday, the facts would begin drifting their way out of her brain, as facts are wont to do when they are being ignored. But Anna didn't know, and so she continued her confident stride to the building's entrance. As well she should have, because after all, Anna was the world's 800,239,438th best knitter, the 4,124,345th most accomplished backgammon player, and had the 1,897,763rd largest collection of greeting cards. And that, as we all know, is enough.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Ashley Cowger, reading from her collection of short stories, Peter Never Came, published by Autumn House Press. So Ashley, in that story, there's this tension between kind of this real precision and then this fleetingness that happens. And it, you know, you can't help, especially hearing you read the story, how many times you have to make your way through numbers in it. And I just want to ask you about kind of, you know, where that story came from and, you know, where, how you made it work with the numbers, that kind of stuff.
I wanted to write a story about this idea of how everybody wants to be the best at something, you know, and that people just have this obsession with being the number one, whatever it is that you do or whatever it is that's important to you. And I was really interested in the idea that it really doesn't matter, because if you were the number one, you wouldn't even know it. And on top of that, there can't be a number one. I mean, these things are subjective. So it doesn't even really make sense anyway. So we're just sort of wasting our time worrying about these things that don't matter. So I wanted to write a story about that. And so when I was just sort of trying to decide how to frame that and what to do, this first sentence just popped into my mind, this idea of having a woman be the number one most beautiful woman in the world for 5 minutes, but she doesn't even know that she's the number one. So then from there, I just sort of took off with it. I just kind of went, and all these vast numbers just sort of kind of popping up at me as I was working on the story.
Sure. And you know, the idea that there's also, we get it with the farming salmon, but with the beauty, we don't really get why she got bumped off from the number one position. It's like, did somebody, you know, get a new hairdo, or, you know, what happened that all of a sudden they became prettier.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, it's interesting because immediately it made me start thinking of, you know, the way we've become a society that just votes on the popularity of everything, the singers that we like, the books that we think are the best, all that kind of thing. And that just kind of takes it and brings it into another frame. I wanted to talk also a little bit about the collection as a whole, the title of the book. There, again, in terms of thinking about kind of how things hold together or the tension that binds them, there's obviously something, Peter, that's being referred to as Peter Pan, this tension between what we anticipate will happen when we're young, what happens when we're older, that kind of thing. So could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I had written just a bunch of different stories that sort of dealt with this idea of being a kid and thinking that the world is one way, and then growing up and kind of realizing what the world actually is, and learning to kind of accept the world for what it is, and realizing that it's actually not so bad, that it's different from what you thought as a kid. And of course, I'm sure you could assume that I'm a huge Peter Pan fan. Peter Pan is probably my favorite book of all time. And so I've always been very interested in this idea of this boy who chooses to remain a child forever because he just doesn't want to deal with reality and kind of what grown-up life actually has to offer you. So I just had, when I decided I was going to try and put stories together into a collection, I just realized that I had a ton of stories that all seemed very thematically linked with that idea. So then I tried to lay them out in a way where there might be a sort of progression to them, where we would start with stories about children and kind of children learning what the world actually is, and then have some stories about adults maybe being kind of depressed about the world not being what they wanted it to be, and then sort of maybe ultimately end with this idea that we can learn to accept the world for what it is and sort of see the beauty in the world, even though it's not magical and there's not, you know, fairy dust and pirates and exciting things like that.
Now, when you were writing the stories, were those kind of phases that you were going through yourself as a writer, or did it just kind of happen that you looked back and went, look, here's this kind of mosaic of stories?
I think there were some phases. The oldest story in here that I actually wrote it when I was an undergrad is actually Peter Never Came, the title story. And when I wrote that story, that was very much what I was interested in. I was, you know, in my early 20s at the time. I was sort of exploring, realizing that life wasn't what I had wanted it to be. And so then I was writing a lot about that kind of thing. And then I started writing more stories about childhood. And then I ultimately started writing stories about kind of seeing the beauty in the world in spite of that it's not magical.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things in terms of kind of bringing a contemporary lens to the Peter Pan story, particularly in the earlier stories in the book where they are through the eyes of children, you know, the things that we're getting through their perspective is a little, they're much more sinister than the things that happen in Peter Pan's world. He, mm-hmm. you know, it turns the perspective with Peter Pan. It's just this kind of insistence that he's going to stay in this land of imagination and youthfulness, but not with any kind of sense that other than maybe having to like pay the bills and, you know, that kind of thing when you get older, that there's something that terrible on the other side.
Right.
But there are some really dangerous things in the other side. So was that a deliberate layering on, or was that just kind of the sensibility of the way the world is now?
I think it was deliberate. I'm sure probably some of these things were still problematic, you know, even when James M. Barrie was writing Peter Pan. But I think he was maybe trying to be a little bit more maybe kind of keep it a bit more whimsical and maybe lay aside some of the problems of reality for that, you know, 300 pages or whatever it was. But yeah, I think I felt like I'm just going to face these things head on. I'm going to deal with the fact that, you know, little kids end up kind of in these awkward situations that really force them to grow up sooner than they're ready to.
Right.
And, you know, explore that.
Right. You know, with Peter Pan, he could make the choice not to grow up. But with these kids, they don't really have that option because there's just things in their environment that unless they wanted to completely be delusional and deny that they exist, they have to come to terms with.
Exactly. Exactly. And a lot of the stories in that first section about childhood are really about that moment where each of these kids are put in this position where something happens that is really going to kind of force them to grow up a little bit. And it's the kind of things that we don't want kids to have to deal with, but they do have to deal with it.
Right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Ashley Cowger, reading from her collection of short stories, Peter Never Came, published by Autumn House Press. Ashley, would you read some more?
Sure. So I'm going to read a little excerpt from the longest story in this collection, which I had written for a novella class that I took when I was an MFA student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And just to give you a little background, because I'm kind of jumping into the novella already in progress, what this story is about is it's about a woman who is an adult. She's a grown woman, but she has a little doll who, when she was a child, her doll came to life. And so it sort of arrested her development, and she's sort of still behaves and kind of thinks like a child does because she's had this doll as her best friend her entire life. So she's just gone out and gotten her first job as an adult. And she's talking about her coworker who shares a cubicle space with her. His desk is scattered with papers and office supplies. Loose pens, a stapler, a random distribution of different sized paper clips. Lined up in neat succession along the wall is a series of little plastic men. Men in capes, men with masks, men with hard, flexed muscles and carefully painted grimaces. I stare at them for a second, look from the men to Michael, who looks nothing like any of them, and back to the men. Some of them are squatting. Some hold guns or grenades. One has a quiver strapped to his back. For a second, I wonder if these are the right kind, like Mindy. But as I take in their stiff little plastic bodies, their painted facial expressions and clothes, I know that they aren't. Either they're not the right type, or Michael isn't. But either way, they're nothing more than toys, these men. And I can tell toys are all they'll ever be. I reach into my shoulder bag and pull out Mindy. After I prop her up on the desk beside the computer, I drop my now empty bag on the floor and kick it under my desk. I sit down and say, "Okay, I'm situated." Michael swivels his chair around and looks at Mindy's shiny purple eyes, the smudged plastic on her face, her hands, her legs, and her long black hair, which is beginning to mat a little with age. He laughs, but not in a mean way. "Michael, I'd like you to meet Mindy. Mindy, this is Michael." I pull her string and she says, "My name's Mindy, and I love you." Michael laughs again and stands up, steps to my desk and reaches his hand out to shake Mindy's. "Pleasure to meet you." He looks me in the eyes. The red spider webs cross his neck again, and he turns away. He points to the little men stationed at the back of his desk and says, "Those are my ones." And he doesn't look at me as he says it. "Yeah, I saw them. Who are they?" I roll my chair over and pick up one of the guys, a man with huge muscles and red hair that spirals off the top of his head. "Just different action figures from when I was a kid," he says. "That's the Fickle Fire." "The Fickle Fire?" I ask. "You don't remember the Fickle Fire? I used to watch it every Saturday morning. I never had a TV. My Grammy said it's bad for your mind." I pump the man's little plastic arms up and down and inspect his chipped body, his tiny removable laser gun. "Wow," I say, "this is so cool." I squeeze the gun between my thumb and index finger and point it at Michael, pretending to shoot at him. I say, "Pew, pew." Michael is supposed to grab his chest, through which the laser has quite thoroughly burned a hole, but he doesn't. He just laughs and says, "Yeah, you gotta have something to get you through the days of slogging through CPT and ICD-9 codes."
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Ashley Cowger, reading from her collection of stories, Peter Never Came, published by Autumn House Press. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about form, because you started out tonight reading from a shorter piece, and this is from a novella. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about your interest in the short story form, and you're kind of occupying all three spots within the form, right? The very, very short form, the kind of standard short story size, which tends to be, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20 pages, and then the novella, which is longer. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit why you're a short story writer, what interests you about the form?
I really like kind of economy with words. You know, as a reader, I really like it when I can read something and I feel like not a single word was wasted. Every single word that was used should have been there. And on the other hand, I tend to get frustrated as a reader when I feel like, you know, I read a 800-page novel and it could have been written in 400 pages. So I've always sort of leaned towards trying to find the shortest, most concise way that I can get at any particular story. So I do write a lot of flash fiction, which tends to be, you know, roughly 3 pages, give or take, or less. And I like that form. I know a lot of people kind of cringe and they say, "Well, how can you tell a complete story in 3 pages? But I really feel like you can. You have to really pick your words carefully. And you end up sort of at this crossroads between poetry and prose, I feel like, because you're really picking every single word very carefully. You're making sure that your sentences are very elegant, that they work exactly the way you want them to work. And the longer the piece gets, the less you're able to worry about every single individual word.
So, you know, approaching it from the language side, do you start out with something longer and then pare back? Or do you try to put that pressure on yourself from the get-go, that you just really, you have to create a sentence that is exactly what you want to say?
I don't worry too much about getting the sentences exactly right on the first draft, but I don't tend to be, you know, an incredibly kind of verbose writer. I'm not one of those writers who writes, you know, huge first drafts that then have to be trimmed by 50%. My first drafts are usually roughly the length that the final draft will be. And I'll end up changing a lot of things during the revision process, but the length usually ends up about the same, give or take.
Sure. And you know, in talking with writers who write flash fiction, I do think there's a real concentration on language much in the same way that poets work. But then the other thing I'm interested in has to do with the kind of character and plot development. Mm-hmm. Because with poetry, not that there isn't, of course, there's a huge tradition of narrative poetry that has kind of characters and things happen in it and it moves down the page that way. But, you know, it seems like language is primary and helps to really put it in a pressure cooker and create, you know, what the ultimate final product's going to be. Mm-hmm. But with character and plot, do you know what's going to happen ahead of time? And so that lets you to then just really concentrate on the language? Or are you still kind of working out those kind of character plot issues at the same time?
With flash fiction, I usually do know what's going to happen. And that tends to be kind of the determining factor between whether I'm going to write a regular story, a more traditional length, or whether I'm going to write a flash fiction piece. If I have the whole story in my head from the moment I sit down to start writing, I pretty much know that means it's going to be flash fiction because, you know, I'm not that kind of big and expansive with world building. So if I've already got the whole plot, it's going to be 3 pages or less.
Sure. Now, what about the novella? How did that develop? Because that's a form that typically, you know, especially editors and publishers sometimes will kind of blanch when they hear the word novella. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and it's hard to get a novella published. Mm-hmm. So for a novella, I feel like it's definitely more of kind of an exploration process. And I think it's very similar to the way you might write a novel, where you don't know what's going to happen. So for this novella, I just sort of had this really vague idea that I thought, well, what would happen if a little girl actually had a doll come to life? Like, how would that affect her life? And then I didn't know what was going to happen in the story beyond that, mm-hmm. But I just thought it would be an interesting thing to explore, and I figured I would find the answers to that question through the process of writing the story.
Did it ever have an impulse to become something longer than it did?
It never did, this one, and I think it was maybe because when I first started it, I was writing what I thought was going to be just a 15 to 20-page short story. Mm-hmm. And then when I got that done and I got some feedback on it and I sat down to revise it, I realized that I wasn't really ready to let it go yet, that it felt like there was more that needed to happen and more that needed to be said. But it never crossed my mind that it might become a whole novel. I just thought, okay, well, there's a novella class next semester, so I'm going to sign up for that and I'll write this in that class.
Well, and that's good that there was kind of that place for you to land as well, because it is true. There's, you know, I think there's been more talk about it, particularly with kind of changes in the way that we read literature these days. We read them on electronic devices and mm-hmm. Online that, you know, length, I think, is something that's kind of more open-ended these days. And if anything, the novel, at times, people are worried about its survival because of, you know, sustaining that kind of attention on something that is in a handheld book, not that there aren't still those. Right. But, you know, I'm wondering if the novella isn't going to come back as a form because it's just a little bit longer, but it does kind of give that satisfaction of being able to spend more time with a character.
Yeah, I actually feel like the novella is almost kind of the perfect form because it's got the concision that you get from a short story. It's got that more economy of language and carefully chosen words, but it's got the story arc and the kind of room to explore this world and really get to know these characters that you expect from a novel. So you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Right, right. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Ashley Cowgirl, reading from her story collection, Peter Never Came, by Autumn House Press. Would you read some more for us, Ashley?
Sure. So I'm going to read a little excerpt from one of my sort of traditional-length short stories. And this story is called This Is Not a Fairy Tale. And what's happening at this point in the story is that this little girl, the main character, Lucy, her parents died. They burned up in a fire at their flower shop when she was very little, so she never got to meet her parents. And now she's being raised by her grandparents. They didn't want Lucy to forget her parents, who had loved her so much that they let their bodies burn so that Lucy might know something better than wilted flowers. So Gramps put a picture of Lucy's parents on her bedside table. The frame was wooden and peeling, and Lucy got splinters the few times she tried to pick it up. There had been a crack in the glass, so Gramps had taken it off, and the photo, perhaps from age or from exposure to the humid farmhouse air, had begun to bow out in the center, held in place by the frame on its top and bottom. It looked like the picture was trying to escape. The image itself, the only image Lucy would ever know of her parents, had been taken with a cheap camera, and the film had been overexposed. Lucy's parents' skin was too white against their black clothes, and their eyes blazed red from the intensity of the camera's flash. And their smiles, which were warped on one side each where they pressed their cheeks together, were too big and too deliberate to be genuine. Lucy thought they looked like they were taunting her, like they wanted to remind her again and again that they would break free of this frame eventually, and once they did, there would be nothing to protect her. But Graham and Gramps didn't know that the picture frightened Lucy, and so every night after the chores were done, Graham would tuck Lucy in and kiss her on the cheek and tell her a story about her mother. "When your mom was just a little girl," Graham would say, "she insisted I buy her a fluffy white cat. She named him Kindness and brought him with her everywhere. Thought he would keep the witches away." And Lucy would look at the picture on her nightstand, her mom and her dad with gaping smiles and eyes glowing red, and Lucy would think, they're dead. Their bodies were engulfed in flames, and they're dead. And Lucy would wonder if Kindness had worked, or if her mom was a witch now, or a ghost.
One of the things I'm wondering, when you're writing for a young adult audience, it's different, but your stories, to me, are for an adult audience. I think mm-hmm. that's, again, where it's a little bit different than Peter Pan, because that kind of operates on two levels, right? But mm-hmm. there is subject matter in the book that it's through this kind of innocent child lens, but obviously is written to an adult audience. But as a writer, what do you find intriguing about trying to inhabit that youth voice? Mm-hmm. You know, I think about the old adage in acting, you know, don't act with kids or animals because they'll steal the stage. I think as a writer, you know, you don't see a lot of younger voices when it's written for an adult audience. It does tend to kind of stay in that YA fiction level. So when what's interesting about it, and what's the biggest challenge for you?
I think it's interesting because in a lot of ways, I feel like growing up isn't really what you kind of expected it to be, that you become an adult, but in a lot of ways you still feel like a little kid inside. You know, I'm in my 30s, but I feel like I'm about 8 on the inside. And I still feel like I look at the world in a lot of the same ways that a little kid might look at the world. So I've always been very kind of drawn to the sort of child's perspective and trying to write stories from that perspective and thinking about, well, how does a child see the world and what does a child get wrong about the world and what does a child actually get right that maybe sometimes adults get wrong when we're looking at the world. So I think it's a really kind of rich and interesting perspective to take on. It's definitely challenging, though, because I don't have a lot of kids around me just on a regular basis. My daughter is just 14 months old. She's about to turn 14 months, so she's not, she's not like an 8-year-old.
She's not critiquing your stories for you?
Exactly. She can't really give me that feedback that I might otherwise kind of want to have just to make sure that I'm getting the voice right or I'm kind of getting the way of looking at the world right. So I really have to try and be careful about it and try and not be false when I'm trying to write from that perspective.
Sure. Well, Ashley, thanks for coming to Prosody. We appreciate you visiting us.
And thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5 WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Saturday at 6:30 for Prosody on Pittsburgh's NPR news station, 90.5 WESA.